Now open. We've got two items on our agenda today. Before we get started, we should mention, too, we've got only one more bill committee, a House bill that's coming over, or is it already over, Sue?
It had third readings. It should be here tomorrow for the Senate.
First reading tomorrow. That'll be the only bill we have left. It's the one that has to do with energy efficiency in state buildings. Oh. So it'll come to our committee, and then that should just about wrap up this committee's business for the session. Today we have Gary Hansen, and Gary, why don't you come up, and if you're going to bring Mr. Briggs with you or anybody. Gary's got an informational hearing for Mr. Hansen, and then after that, Representative Bonamici will be here to give us an update on the pesticide use work group that we appointed at the end of last session. Mr. Hansen.
Thank you, Chair Ivankian. My name is Gary Hansen. I reside in North Portland. Chair Ivankian and members of the committee, I'd first like to thank you for this opportunity to come before you and make this presentation. While oil filters make a relatively small percentage of the waste stream, safely recycling these nasty little buggers is incredibly important. The simple fact is that oil filters contain oil, oil that can be recycled time and time again. Even a cup of oil, multiplied by 6 million annual oil changes in Oregon, is a lot of oil. Oil that we don't need to import, oil that won't leak into our landfills, oil that will not end up in groundwater. Oil can be used time and time again. Motor oil doesn't wear out, it just gets dirty. Cleaning and reusing oil, motor oil, is at the top of the recycling hierarchy. Our state's private industry leader on this issue is Oil Refining Company of Portland. It collects filters from as far away as Bend and Klamath Falls. Before I ask ORCO President Mr. Briggs to step up, he's already stepped up.
Yeah.
So a brief visual aid, I'd like to lay out our plan for recycling these filters. In the 2009 session, we'll ask for legislation requiring vendors of oil filters to make available a method of recycling them. This will be very compatible with the current program that's used to recycle the oil itself. After the bill is drafted, we'll share it with DEQ's waste management and land quality staff, Metro, and the automobile industry. In informal talks up until now, we believe we can achieve consensus on this. We've had some real strong endorsements. They're waiting until they see the bill, but we've had a lot of strong interest and some attaboys on it. There's a great value in reusing this resource. There's a great value in keeping oil out of landfills and groundwater. But most importantly, we can create another way for the citizens of Oregon to help sustain our environment. Mr. Briggs?
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. I'm happy to be here in front of the committee today. I'm an Oregonian, which at 73 years old, I've admired the state for a long, long time. So with that being said, I've been in the oil business a long time, and I've given you each a packet, and I'd only spend a moment or two on it just to give you some warm-up statistics. Basically, there's a lot of them on the top page. There's at least 2 million gallons a year of oil that's wasted in the landfill, as Gary already talked about. Page two on the bottom catches you up on what we're talking about, the little oil filter thing that I'll give you a little better presentation out of the five-gallon buckets. The third page, where it talks about benefits of re-refining versus burning, one of the most important things to understand is that used oil that's taken from the crankcase to Jiffy Lube, the car dealers, less than 1% of all the crude in the world is motor oil stock. So it's not like a diesel fuel or a gasoline that there's millions and millions and millions of gallons or barrels of crude. There's only 1% or less. And so the material never wears out. It can be reused again and again and again. And fortunately, I've been able to install a refinery 3 years ago, a re-refinery in Portland, one of the first in the last 20 years, the second in the Northwest. We just completed a new one outside of Reno. We found the model now. It's kind of like Starbucks. We're beginning to be able to say, put them wherever they're needed rather than just someone waiting for a $100 million check to come along to see if they can install one. Today, we're doing it for about $15 million. So it's changed the whole status of how we're refining one. One of the feedstocks is used oil from oil filters. There's another one from burning oil in the shop heaters, but that's another subject. So it's important to understand that we're talking about 1% of all the available crude in the world is available to make into motor oils. The fourth little item there gives you a little idea where we're located, and that we're advancing regularly all the time. Our word really is sustainability in all the things that we do. With that in mind, let me give you a little early program. Thank you, Charles. The thing that you want to see here, this is 5 oil filters, and within one day, they drain this much oil out. That's very significant. And that's what goes in your landfill now, and everything but some of the jiffy loops, some of the cargo that we're picking up, about 450 barrels a month in the order of entry of oil filters. It's probably 4,000. So the other, because they're allowed to go in the landfill, they go in. And of course, there's a certain rules for doing that. They're supposed to be punched on top. They're supposed to be hot drained. And you'll find almost out of these 5, only one is punched. In this case, since we recycle them, that's not too important because we capture it all. We catch the oil, we get it all, and then we would shred it. Wouldn't be unusual. Here's your fluff. A very good hog glue. Got more BTUs than wood waste would have by a long way. I happen to have 3 committed burners, so I can burn it to make the heat and use this to recover the oil. The heat distills to separate the different oils, then finally to take the water and evaporate the water rather than use the sewer. So we don't have any waste in our operations. We do make one that goes to the landfill, and one would call it a waste perhaps, but it is simply an ash. And so after I burned everything and all the dirt and the kitty litter for cleanup, so what might be
is that thing safe to pass around up here without us making a mess?
Well, that's just the ash, but it's not heavy. I happen to use it as a product.
It's amazing.
The product really is a solidification. Well, you'll see as an example. You see, here's a non-typical oil stream coming to you. But here's dirt and solids in the bottom. Certainly animals if you want, but I didn't necessarily come to that. But there's dirt in the bottom, so the dirt's going to be burnt. I'm going to recover the water and the oil out of the water. I'm going to recover that oil. I'm going to recover that oil. We're going to ultimately come to here, which is brand new motor oil stocks, top of the line, no, nothing better than virgin, because very simply, we get a motor oil, or we get a base stock that's been refined once by the refiner, and refined by your car the second time, and by the third time we get it, now has an additive package in it, which is generally about 15 or 20%. It's something to give you extreme pressure and rust and a wear detergent and all the other characteristics of the oil. So we have a product that's better than the virgin material. And from that, to the oil filter side, then back, so we would shred, and then we would have all the metal that's been shredded from the oil filters, and we would then make it into either new metal or rebar, as an example. It's easier to pack this than a big chunk of metal. We can burn them directly if you'd like, and burn everything out and then take it to the scrappers to do that. So the problems exist. There's a lot of other oil filters that are out there that no one thinks about. There's one. That's probably a fuel filter from a diesel truck. Here's one that's probably from a gasoline filter in your car. And we certainly don't want the gasoline, and we don't want that in the landfill. There's benzene and all the other things in it. And of course, we get a wonderful one that comes out of your transmission. If you cover the metal out of it, some of that's plastic. And so the plastic can be shredded out and used for us, too. Gives you an idea. This one, we put in about 15 crush filters, and we still get a little water on it. You can see after days of work that we get a little water on, but we still recover that. That comes back to us. I don't want to take your whole day on what we're doing here, but I'm certainly open for questions. One of the biggest things that we find is sustainability in today's world with Mr. Green and all of that. The sustainability in me means several things. One of the things is that you can take used antifreeze from your car, from ice rinks, from food plants where they have freezing and they use antifreeze in it. We recover that. That's new ethylene alcohol. Made 40% of that is ethylene alcohol. We can make plastics out of it, we can use antifreeze out of it. I happen to make the best in new antifreeze because the customer that creates this helps to buy replacement product. So I can make a better deal with him and say, I'll pick it up and I'll give you back at a better price. The same thing happens with motor oil. When we can take this coming out of your crankcase back into this, sustainability never wears out. Never wears out. This is one of the latest one I've been doing, and that's all waste plastic back into oil, back to the plastic industry. And that we have one new one in Ohio that's just going in, and that's new technology that we designed. Questions now at this point. I'm probably considered an expert in the world on used oil, holy water, cleanup rags, and blooms, all kinds of those things. But we came here on oil farms, and any questions you'd like, I can certainly answer.
Sure. Go ahead and have a seat again in committee. Senator Girard.
The question I have is, it sounds like an interesting process. Do you, like the weight of oil, like, you know, there's 30 weight, 1040, 1030. How do you get the different weight oils out of that, or is it just kind of a combination?
What happens in this case, incoming, it's all there.
Yeah.
And so as we process, it takes out various cuts in it. For instance, the first cut would be a water gasoline cut, generally 2-3% of what comes in, because it's mostly blow-by and fuel dilution. The next one would be a diesel cut, and it'd be about 6%. The next one would be a light, very much like this, a light we would call 100 neutral high VI base oil. And so if you want that for your car, which is a 0-30, if you look on the newer cars, they'll say that the motor oil should be from a 0-30 or a 530 oil or something like that. That's a very thin oil, but it's not any thinner than your automatic transmission oil. It's not any thinner than a light hydraulic oil would be. So that would come off next, actually turns to vapor, cools it, it's on the other side. Then we go a little deeper with more heat, more vacuum. We take off a product like a 1540, which is for your heavier motor oils today. And this is a situation that would be cooled and back into another base stock. And then finally, our bottoms are an asphalt. So we don't have any waste there. All the things I didn't want earlier on now is earning an asphalt, and that's a product that your road asphalt would normally have about 3% of it. Your shingle on your roof would be the three-tab fiberglass shingles. Generally, are about 10% asphalt for waterproof and flexibility. So basically, it's by separation in the plant we make a different grade for different uses.
Interesting.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I have to tell you, it takes me back to my organic chemistry days where we practically blew up the lab twice, but, you know, I'm sure you guys do a better job of distilling the stuff off than we did. My real question is, where are you as far as getting people to cooperate with the program? I mean, what do you need from this bill? You obviously got the technology to do this, to recycle everything and keep recycling it.
I think more than anything, we just need to get it in front of the public. I don't see a great disadvantage to it. There will be some that would say the small repair shops and whatnot would probably have some. Well, I'm going to have to pay somebody to take this away now. Well, he's paying you now. in his garbage disposal to some degree, and he will pay a little more, but the volume of it's probably in a small automotive shop, probably one barrel a month, $50. And so if there is objection, it'll be from that. But when you see the drippy oil filter going into his garbage, you have to question whether that is too concerning or not.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. The other two areas I'm always concerned about is I know a lot of people at home change their own oil out yet on their lawnmowers and tractors and cars, and I know a lot of them just pour it down the drain. I mean, we hate to say that, but it does happen. Is you're thinking of some way of collecting that up also, and along with that, what about farmers? I mean, I farm myself, and I have to take my oil in, and I try to talk people at Jiffy Lube taking it and whatnot. It's a little bit of a battle sometimes.
Well, the system, actually, the service system, there's people in any area, so it can be provided for. Many of them, you know, they have, as an example, in some landfills, they'll have a separate box for oil and one for antifreeze and one for oil filters and so on, and that can happen. There is a box actually that's designed and for curbside. It can be done that you can put a gallon or two of oil in it. You can drop your oil filter in the oil if you want. Tie the bag. It's in a box. It can go back. You can put it in a jug and a can, and the man could take it. But it's one of those, how do we get to the do-it-yourself, or how do we get to the single guy? It can be done. It isn't being done well now. And, of course, those, if we can get the most of the commercial, what's happened in the do-it-yourself oil industry is about 90% of the do-it-yourselfer now has made its transition to the Jiffy Lube, the Quick Lube. And most of that now comes through there. It's not really as prominent as it used to be.
Well, the question I would have is, if you wanted a statewide policy, I could understand that this could work maybe in the Valley, but you get out in Burns, Oregon, or Ione, or someplace like that, it just seems like they would have a lot more trouble with the recycling part of this. Don't you see a problem kind of from a regional perspective?
No, we actually cover. We have trucks that go through those areas. And for Burns as an example, we go in there at least twice a month. Most of the cases, the landfill area supplies us with something to take care of the oil that comes in, something that comes to antifreeze, something that comes in with oil filters, and there'll be a little drop box there, and they'll fill them up, and we'll pick them up and rotate them out. In the landfills, we don't even charge for them. In fact, we're paying now the landfills for the used oil because the price now is elevated. That the street price, which we used to be able to say to you, well, you got 100 gallons, we'll pick it up for nothing. Today, 100 gallons is probably worth 15 cents a gallon. The Jiffy Lubes, the Quick Lubes, now are getting as much as 70 cents a gallon for their oil. But that's the change in our world economy, and the crude price is doing that. So service is available everywhere.
Part of our task in developing this, I've dealt with it now for about a year. It's pretty complicated in terms of DEQ. I'll have to do some administrative rulemaking and the various landfills and stuff, metro and the Portland metro area. We'll have to come up with some policies to coordinate all of these. But the key is to try and keep that collection system for the filters very similar to the collection system that's already in place for the oil. And that's... that oil is a pretty comprehensive system that I think covers the vast majority of Oregon. There may be one or two places that we might be problematic, but where 95% of the people live, I think there's a collection method in place.
Give us the heads up on what you think the bill might look like. I mean, what it would direct people to do.
Well, it would direct the vendors that are selling the oil filters to also have create an opportunity for people to recycle. And that's the heart of it, how that would go through with administrative rules and whether that means at the store that's actually selling the filter or if they can say there's another location.
It seems to me like and this isn't, I'm going to use the word simple, but it isn't simple, a simple landfill ban on oil floaters, then the system's already there to take care of it if they weren't allowed to go in landfill.
All right. Anything else, committee? All right. Thank you both very much.
Thank you for your time.
It makes sense, though.
It's an interesting thing, and I've actually been out to Mr. Briggs' plant and seen the machinery and how it works. I mean, it's really a fascinating system. If any of you were in town and wanted to go, I'm sure he'd be glad to have you.
Yeah.
We can make arrangements.
Yeah. Very good.
So the bill will be...
Thank you.
Next session.
Next session. But are you going to have it in the interim for us to look at?
If you would like to see it during the interim, we'd be glad to schedule
it. Mr. Chair, it seems like you should be building those relationships and, you know, talking to all the various groups and building a little support. You're just saying if there are issues, maybe, you know, maybe farmers have issues, maybe logging industries have issues, and they, you know, I can think of all the oil that I've put in proper containers.
Yes.
I think they're building it, and that's why I wanted to have them here in the interim so that we were ready for it next session. Thanks.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Gary, I'd like to work with you on it. Okay. Yeah. Good.
All right, Representative Bonamici, come on up. If the committee remembers, at the end of last session, we appointed a work group on pesticide use. Representative Bonamici is chairing that work group and has been working very hard and meeting throughout the interim. I had asked her to come back during this session just to give us an update on the progress of the group. And so that brings us to today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Chair Avakian, Vice Chair Girard, nice to see you again. I'm Representative Suzanne Bonamici, and I want to start by thanking Senator Avakian for giving me the opportunity to work on this important issue. And I'm here to present the report from the what we've been calling the Committee on Pesticide Use in and Around Schools. I will not be reading the report verbatim, but I will be summarizing the recommendations and topics for further discussion that the work group has identified. So, Chair Avakian and committee, I want to start by telling you that we have involved in this work group a very diverse group of participants with views that range across the spectrum. We met as a full work group four times in October, November, December, and January. And then we formed a subcommittee that has met three times, November, December, and January. The work group got quite large. In fact, we outgrew our meeting space and at one point had to limit the number of people who were participating. We have a list on the back of the report. The last two pages lists all the participants. We included citizens. I made the decision to include some citizens on the work group, even though a couple of people suggested I not do that. I personally believe that we need to get more citizens involved in government, and I also believe it's important for citizens to hear the viewpoint of others as well. Our goal essentially is to minimize the exposure, especially of children, to pesticides. And we focused on schools for a couple of reasons, and that's the ability to affect a large number of children and the feasibility of implementation of policy with so many children attending schools. And our first consensus recommendation, we have six recommendations. The first three we have broad consensus on. The others we're still working on. Our first consensus recommendation is that all Oregon public schools should implement integrated pest management. Integrated pest management is a pest control strategy that uses steps to deter pest problems and reduce the sources of food, water, and shelter for pests. And it uses a combination of practices, according to the EPA, to manage
manage pest damage by the most economical means and with the least possible hazard to people, property, and the environment. 14 states require integrated pest management in schools, and the EPA recommends it for schools. But in Oregon, most districts do not use integrated pest management, and the practices vary widely across the state. The Oregon Environmental Council did a study in 2005 and found that most school districts had no pest management policy in place. The work group recommends that integrated pest management be implemented in K through 12 schools, ESDs, and community colleges. We had some discussions about whether Head Start, pre-K, and private school should be included. We're continuing to discuss those issues, but our consensus is on the K-12 ESD and community colleges. There is assistance available in many places on this issue. Oregon State University, for example, has been very helpful. The agency's Department of Agriculture. There's a lot of resources available through, for example, the IMP STAR program through the Integrated Pest Management Institute. Districts that have current integrated pest management policies like Portland and Eugene have done a great deal of work and can be helpful. In fact, their Integrated Pest Management Institute has a STAR certification program where they recognize school districts that have successfully integrated pest management, and one of those is in Vancouver, Washington. One of the things that we discussed was the need to have a verifiable integrated pest management to make sure that there's monitoring along the way so that we can assure that it's serving its purposes. We are still talking about costs of implementing integrated pest management in schools and are gathering data on that, but there is a note there in the report that talks about how integrated pest management policies can actually save costs in the long run. So we'll be looking carefully at that. And then I also want to note a related issue of raised awareness as districts start looking at integrated pest management policies. We've heard about districts that actually go through and gather old pesticides that are sitting on shelves, things that are no longer permitted to be used or things that should be disposed of. So that's just an awareness raising issue that we've heard about in some districts. The second consensus recommendation is related, and it has to do with the timing of when the district should have and the school should have integrated pest management. We talked about the differences of implementing something like this by incentive or by mandate, and recognizing that we get more buy-in by incentive, and we have had, I want to mention, a lot of education groups involved, a Confederation of School Administrators and Oregon School Boards Association and Oregon Education Association and the Department of Education have all been involved in the work group. But we do want to have a timeline. So we decided to start with a recommendation of an incentive program. If there is some funding available for grants similar to the PE bill that we did in the last session to implement integrated pest management earlier, if that funding is available for early implementation. But if not, I'm confident that we'll be able to do that. Our recommendation is by 2012. And I did note in the report that that's a pretty lenient time frame. We discussed the amount of time that districts will need to do this and arrived at consensus on the year 2010 for the implementation. The third consensus recommendation that we have is to require that application of pesticides in public schools be done by licensed applicators. And in fact, when I've talked about this with people, they're surprised that that isn't required already. And in fact, it's not. And although integrated pest management is generally expected to reduce pesticide use, it does not completely eliminate it because there still may be situations in integrated pest management where pesticides are used. So the work group recommends that chemical pesticides be applied by a licensed and trained applicator. We want to clarify that integrated pest management policies may involve things like pulling weeds or setting a mouse trap, and that's not the kind of thing we want to require licensing for, but we want to make sure that chemical pesticides, if applied in schools, are done by somebody who's had training. And again, we're still studying the cost of that licensing and with the hope that the implementation of integrated pest management can actually save costs. We're hoping that this won't be a significant burden on the districts. And again, there's a lot of resources out there to help the districts implement. And the districts that we've heard from and some that we've talked to and are mentioned in the Oregon Environmental Council report, they indicate an interest in learning more. They want to be involved in this. So there's a lot of incentive on the parts of the districts to get involved. The fourth recommendation is to require public schools to notify parents, faculty, and staff prior to a pesticide application. 19 states currently require notification before a pesticide is applied and used in a school. And even though the integrated pest management will, as I explained, likely reduce the number of pesticide applications, there are still many parents, some faculty and staff that want to know before they're applied during schools. Several states, including Washington, for example, has a Children's Pesticide Right to Know Act that requires notification before a pesticide is used in a school. And there's two different types of notification. There's notification before the pesticide is applied, and there's notification at the site of application. One of the things that we talked about was how schools want to have some flexibility in how they do that, whether it be by sending notes home in backpacks, posting something on a bulletin board, by email. Many schools use email now to contact their school community. But we do know that there are many examples in other states and in Oregon of schools that currently notify parents and faculty and staff. The notification is not to provide, for example, a public hearing or something like that on the application of the pesticide, but to give parents the option and faculty and staff of staying away from the site if they so choose. The fifth recommendation is to continue work on ways to eliminate, reduce and eliminate pesticide drift. Now, Senator Avakian mentioned that this work group was formed following the last session, and I know you had hearings on Senate Bill 20, which would have established a buffer zone around schools and also the routes that students travel to and from schools. We had a lot of discussions about this. Now, the first recommendations I discussed talk about pesticide use in schools by schools. This particular recommendation deals with pesticide use by adjacent property owners, and so it's a very different situation. And I must say that we didn't reach consensus on the scope or even the existence of the problem, but I believe that we came a long way in identifying some of the issues for further discussion. We talked about the need to gather data on this issue and how prevalent it is. And at first there was a recommendation that we discussed in the group to do some targeted drift collection studies at particular schools. And then when we got a ballpark estimate on how much that would cost, which was about $500,000, many of us agreed that probably wouldn't be money well spent because districts vary significantly from urban to rural, small to large, and it wouldn't really be meaningful information. We talked about a systematic evidence review of existing data that exists currently on this type of issue and pesticide drift. And we noted that in Washington, 2007 in Washington, they passed a bill. It's a voluntary notification, but we're going to be watching this. They're now providing pesticide applicators with contact information for schools, hospitals, nursing homes, and daycares, and asking those applicators to contact those schools, hospitals, nursing homes, and daycares before pesticide application. And they're going to see if that results in a reduction in complaints about pesticide drift. We talked about existing law and how existing law governs pesticide drift, if pesticide drifts onto schools or other property. According to the Environmental Protection Agency, it's the applicator's responsibility to prevent that kind of drift. In fact, the EPA guidance states that the applicator must consider all factors, including wind, speed, direction, and other weather conditions, application equipment, the proximity of people and sensitive areas, and product label directions. So that's existing EPA guidance. And there are court-ordered buffer zones around rivers and streams for specific pesticide use. Also, the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, also known as FIFRA, states that pesticide label conditions under which the product must be used. And on the label itself, it can stipulate that use of the product will not result in drift. So that's on many existing labels. And the departure of that constitutes misuse. Additionally, Oregon law prohibits applying pesticides in a faulty, careless, or negligent manner. And developing cases may support liability for harm based on common law theories of trespass or negligence. So that's the existing law in the area. Enforcement is by the Department of Agriculture, but discretionary. And one area where we did reach a consensus, and I tell you, we had a very broad group in this work group, from the Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We had the Oregon Toxics Alliance, the Farm Bureau, the Department of Agriculture, Department of Human Services, somebody representing the people poisoned by pesticides. The one area in this where we agreed, we had consensus, was that the Department of Agriculture needs additional staff so they can investigate instances and complaints of pesticide drift. And the work group will be discussing the needs of the Department of Agriculture and the costs involved in doing that. Where we reached some agreement in this area is that we do need more information and outreach to all pesticide users in both rural and urban areas about drift reduction technique and how they can reduce drift. There are many different ways of reducing drift. Buffer zones is one of them, but also improved equipment and new application technology. The DEQ Pesticide Stewardship Partnership Program is showing some success at reducing drift and needs some stronger funding. Best management practices for the industry may include the consideration of schools as sensitive areas, and they would be in that area that the EPA recommends considering before application. We need to enhance and improve reporting from the medical community to get more accurate data about the health effects of pesticide drift. And we had a pediatrician come and testify, and also we had representation in our work group from the Department of Human Services, that physicians often do not have the skills needed to identify risks from pesticide exposure and actual pesticide exposure effects. And so we need to enhance that reporting from the medical community so we can get accurate data about the health effects. We had some discussions about buffer zones and if they're established, they need to be narrowly defined. There's a possibility of a takings argument, and I believe that was one of the issues with Senate Bill 20, is that many groups thought that the buffer zones that were proposed in that bill were too wide and would be subject to some challenge. We do agree that pesticide applicators must engage in a site-specific assessment of conditions to avoid drift, and finally that the improvements in drift reduction technology may lead to the establishment of variable buffer zones depending on the technology that's used in the application, because the technology is becoming more and more sophisticated in eliminating drift through the use of technology, and that's all currently being developed. So we had some agreement in those areas in the drift topic where we agree that we need to continue further discussion include buffer zones that are limited to certain EPA-identified chemicals. And there are states, for example, Arizona uses that approach. They'll establish a buffer zone for particular pesticides, but not general buffer zones. One suggestion was that there's a one-size buffer zone around a school for an aerial application and a different buffer zone for ground application because the drift is different from those different application techniques, or buffer zones for aerial spraying only, or at the very least notification to adjacent property owners prior to aerial spraying. So you can see there's still a lot of work to be done in that area, but we have come a long way in identifying the issues, and we'll continue to discuss those. The sixth recommendation is to review the statutory definition of integrated pest management. It's in the statute now in ORS Chapter 634. And the way it's in the statute now, it applies to state agencies that are listed in the statute, and that's on page 13 and 14 of the report. It doesn't apply to K-12 schools or community colleges. It does apply to higher institutes of higher education, but not to K-12 schools or community colleges. So we recognize that implementing a school integrated pest management policy would require some change to that statute. We had some concerns expressed in the work group that this definition in statute is 17 years old. Some members expressed that it really needs more emphasis on the health effects of pesticides. It should require the use of the least toxic alternatives, which is what many of the definitions of integrated pest management use, and that it may not be consistent with some definitions of integrated pest management used by other states. And we started with the premise in our work group that we should have one definition of integrated pest management in the statute, and that's in ORS 634. As we began to have discussions about school use of pesticides in and around schools and implementing integrated pest management policy in schools, we realized that another alternative might exist, and that's, for example, New Jersey and other states have a separate school integrated pest management act. And that makes sense because of the susceptibility of children. It may make more sense to define integrated pest management just for the school act in a way that's different from the current definition and leave the current definition as it applies to agriculture and state agencies. So we still have more work to do. There are some areas for further work and study that are identified on page 15. One of those is expanding integrated pest management to licensed daycare centers. They've done that in California and Illinois. Another discussion we had was about the exposure of infants and children to pesticides from food sources. So that's something to keep in mind as we're encouraging the consumption of more fruits and vegetables. We want to keep an eye on the exposure to pesticides from food sources as it affects infants and children. We discussed, again the need for more education in the medical community to recognize signs to help with accurate reporting of data. The DEQ participated in the work group, and one of the discussions we had that was inspired by something they said was the accumulation of pesticides in wells and water is something we need to take a look at, and also the adverse effects of prenatal exposure to pesticides. Those areas for work, further work and study on page 15 are sort of beyond the scope that we narrowed this work group because we wanted to have a workable topic, but those are things that we wanted to bring to your attention as a committee so that they didn't get lost in all the other work that we've done. So thank you so much, committee, Chair Avakian and committee, for setting up this work group. I want to take the time to thank the work group members, many of whom are here today, for their dedication in this. We had a lot of meetings, and their expertise was very much appreciated. I want to thank you for your attention to this issue, and I want to say that I look forward to continuing the work on this as we go forward and working on recommendations for the 2009 session. And I would be happy to answer your questions.
Anything?
Mr. Chair, that's a pretty impressive report. You guys did a lot of work. Thank you.
Thank you.
I do have a question, and this is one probably more educational, and you may not be able to answer it for me. From what I've just been told, there are already buffer zones and protections for rivers and streams in this state.
That's correct.
Could you give us some idea what that looks like, and was there a discussion about just trying to implement those for schools as sort of a beginning? I mean, for protecting our streams and rivers and lakes, why we're not protecting our kids could be made as an argument, but give me an idea what that actually means and why, what kind of discussion you had around that.
Right. Chair Avakian and Senator Bates, we did have a discussion about that. It was really toward the end of the work group, and we heard the same types of arguments. If we're protecting the salmon, why aren't we protecting the children? And it's a topic that we discussed, and it's my understanding that the buffer zones around streams have been court-imposed rather than by legislation. So we are continuing to discuss as I explained, buffer zones and that, and what we can do to protect children as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, we looked at this before with when we were doing pesticide use reporting, and there was a lot of discussions about how it's applied, when it's applied as far as streams are concerned, of course, which would be a little bit different when kids are in and out of school, but a lot of the same principles seem to apply to both the agricultural societies and agricultural farmers are kind of used to that already. They have some knowledge of it. They're very cooperative. They want things to go the right way for their own water and streams. And it would seem to be sort of a natural discussion to have. I'm surprised it came late in the group. You had so much work to do, obviously, couldn't get everything done at once. Is that going to be part of your discussion as you continue this process?
Chair Avakian and Senator Bass, yes, it will be part of the discussion, and we have had the representatives from the Farm Bureau participating in the work group as well, and I look forward to the cooperation of everyone in continuing to work on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, I just kind of a follow-up. I mean, basically, I'm a farmer and applied pesticides. We it's not as though we're out there groveling in the stuff. You know, we're very careful with it. And I think the farm community, you know, we're under licensing. If I want to apply a certain type of pesticides, I have to have a license to do it. So in my best interest, I just hire somebody else. I don't even want to take the chance of doing it because I think there's some strict liability issues involved with applying pesticides. And you know, in my district, I have 28 cities. This mile or even half mile rule would affect every one of those cities. I mean, there were schools because they're small towns, and it's a lot different than it would be in the valley in some respects. And you know, each part of the state's a little bit different. You know, a wheat farmer, I might apply pesticides one day, and even within an, 1 hour, just around that one particular thing out of that whole of the whole year. So, I mean, I can see there's a lot of issues there that you have to be addressing. But from my viewpoint, I think the industry has addressed a lot of these as they've gone along, and probably some direction from the federal EPA. You know, we have to have these requirements, we have to do the test, take these tests, and all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, I think really the industry is pretty careful about what they do because, we have children too. We don't want them out on the farm. You know, we're pretty careful about that sort of stuff.
Right. Chair Avakian and Senator Nelson, yes, I appreciate that. And one of the things that you said that I wanted to point out is that's one of the reasons you said you hire somebody who's trained. That's one of the reasons why we want to require the licensed applicators to be applying pesticides in schools. That very reason, because it does involve some training, and we want to make sure that people who are using pesticides in schools are trained.
Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there any discussion to try to find out if we really have a problem or not? As an example, I went through a testing program along with some other people last year for all kinds of pollutants in us, and we were surprised to find that two of us, not me, but two others, had pesticides in the system, and I don't know if they knew where those came from or not. But you know, it'd be interesting to know, or at least have a discussion, of whether or not we have areas in the state or not where kids are testing positive for pesticides, or if we test a large number of them, we don't find much. That would be a little reassuring, too. Is there any discussion about that went on?
Chair Avakian and Senator Bates, we didn't talk about the actual testing of children, but we did get some data compiled from the public records information request to both the Oregon Department of Agriculture and the Department of Human Services in October of 2007. And there were 68 cases reported to a state agency involving either schools, school bus stops, or school children traveling to school. And those were the complaints, not necessarily all investigated, I don't think, but there have been complaints made. I don't know about the medical ethical issues of testing children. I'm aware of the study that the Oregon Environmental Council did, but we hadn't talked about testing children.
Thank you.
You had mentioned that there was some type of agreement or consensus on the Department of Ag needing more staffing.
Correct.
Is that staffing relative to research, getting at Senator Bates' question, or enforcement?
Chair Avakian, sometimes I forget the protocol. Chair Avakian, we had that discussion in the context of enforcement, that there were people in our work group who talked about, especially people who live in rural areas, about aerial spraying, about they believe instances of pesticide drift that had not been investigated. And it was our understanding that that was simply a lack of enforcement resources. So the discussion that we had was in the area of enforcement. Research is being done, I might add, by OHSU. There have been people from CROAT, and I'm sorry, I'm using an acronym that I don't remember all the details. It's in the membership group list, and OSU are continuing to do research in this area, and there is research being conducted on the health effects, but our discussion was about enforcement purposes.
And so that would be enforcement under existing law not even taking into account what additional enforcement might be needed under some new law in 2009. Am I interpreting that right?
Well, Chair Avakian, yes, we talked about the need for enforcement under existing law. If, in fact, we propose legislation and it passes in 2009, there may be an additional need. I don't know that at this time.
Anything else, committee? All right.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up one more time on testing of children. You know, we weren't very aware for a long time of lead poisoning occurring in children, and probably wouldn't have really found it if we hadn't tested children.
Mm-hmm.
From a medical ethical point of view, you have to have parental permission, of course. You're not going to test kids without their parents' permission, but it's something that's very doable. I would just consider, if you would, that before we start putting in restrictions and concerns, that we really know what we're dealing with. From the point of view, we might very well find that certain parts of the states, kids are really in trouble in this, and we need to do a lot. In others, it isn't very important. I don't know what we'll find. And it'd be interesting to see those things. What we did with lead was really important from the point of view of inner-city children, especially old houses, of course, that had lead paint and lead that was in the soil from gasoline that was lead additives in the past. So you're really looking at a pretty complex problem. And the fact you've had 60 or 70 complaints already of potential problems from kids going to and from school does give us some pause. And I would think that what you need to do first is define the problem, find out if there is a problem, how big a problem it is, how widespread it is. That might guide you a lot in what you need to do here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Vance. Thank you very much. I appreciate especially your interest and expertise in this area. I know there have been studies of children who live in agricultural, for example, migrant worker areas, and I'd be happy to provide those to you if you'd be interested. One thing I wanted to add is that I know one of the members of the work group, the Oregon Toxics Alliance, wanted to submit something to you, some pictures of a school, and a request that we have permission to continue this work group. And I guess if that's something that's necessary, I respectfully request that the chair give us permission to continue the work group.
I don't know why anybody would have had the impression that something different was going to happen. I fully intended you to keep working all the way through 09 or 2009. That's all you had?
Yes.
For us? Representative Riley? Glad you're here. This committee did an awful lot last session, worked very, very hard. I think one of the smartest things we did is realize this was an important issue, no matter which way it comes out in the end, and selecting Representative Bonamici to head up this work group. She's done a phenomenal job of addressing the really complex issues, substantively and politically, with this. And so thank you for the good work. And I know that many of your work group members are here today, too. And thank you for all the time that you've put in helping us to put together some parameters on the issue and what hopefully will be a good package for us to consider in 09. Committee, anything further? Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
We're adjourned.